Welcome to the podcast, Making Change. I'm your host, Jeff Dunnigan. I work at UBS Financial Services in La Jolla, California, where I provide customized solutions for individuals as well as for nonprofit organizations. A lot of my individual clients are philanthropists, and over the years, I've gathered a pretty good understanding of what motivates philanthropy from both the donor's perspective and also from the point of view of the organizations they support. I've gotten to know a lot of organizations, mostly 501c3, and the people who run them. Sometimes I come across especially creative people who embrace change and who want to see their organizations as leading the future instead of getting dragged into it. In this podcast series, I'll talk to these innovators about their visions and how they're getting there. This is Making Change, a podcast where we get to know leaders who are making changes in Southern California. We'll talk with leaders of organizations committed to positive change in healthcare, housing, the arts, education, and philanthropy. On this episode of Making Change, I'll talk with James Hadan at the Museum of Us in Balboa Park. A few years ago, the Museum of Man changed its name to the Museum of Us to be more inclusive and in line with the times. The name change was just the beginning, though, and it looks like once the name of the museum changes, maybe the whole concept comes up for a refresh. Are you looking at your collections in a different light now that you've changed your name?
We are, actually, Jeff, and we've been really rethinking the way we look at collections, which we refer to as cultural resources, for over a decade now. And, you know, traditionally, museums have really looked at collections or the objects that they held in trust as being owned by the museum. And we really look at the cultural resources that we have and hold as objects that are owned by the communities that we serve. And especially because many of our materials that we hold are from Indigenous and Native American communities. And there has been a whole, you know, history of colonialism which have brought those objects to be at the museum. And so approximately in 2018, we adopted a new policy called the Colonial Pathways Policy. And what that policy says, essentially, is that Indigenous and Native American communities can come to us and say, you have that object and you gained it through a colonial means. You know, that could be a power dynamic. It could be any number of things, including actual, you know, looting from sites. Archaeological looting has occurred in, you know, many cases across the United States. And they can ask for that object or objects back. And we really go through a consultation process with these communities and return objects through that policy. And that policy really kind of adds to federal laws under NAGPRA, which really just are very focused on ancestors or human remains and funerary objects. And so our Colonial Pathways policy goes far, far above that kind of base level of what NAGPRA covers.
The Senator from Hawaii.
Thank you, Mr. President. For centuries, Native people have had everything stolen from them. Their lands, their water, their language, their children. It wasn't that long ago that it was the official policy of the United States government to terminate the existence of tribes and to forcibly assimilate their citizens. And a big part of that unrelenting, inhumane policy was that the remains of Native ancestors and culturally significant items were also taken from them. To remedy this injustice, Congress passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, in 1990. It required museums and universities to quickly return the remains and the items that they were holding that belonged to Native Hawaiians, Alaska Natives, and American Indians. At the time, the Congressional Budget Office anticipated that it would take about 5 years to complete the process of repatriation. 34 years later, It is nowhere close to being done.
So if you're giving things back to people that you decided to give them back to, how did you decide who to give them to, and what if there's a dispute over whose they are?
So, you know, it often depends. So with the NAGPRA process, so this is the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, which really was first implemented by Congress in the 1990s. There is actually a legal process that the federal government lays out, and it's somewhat complex, but everyone kind of understands what that does. The short answer for objects that aren't covered by NAGPRA is that it's complicated, and it really has to do with consultations and relationships that you build with communities. But many of the federally recognized tribes and nations have offices within them or individuals that represent them through those kinds of processes.
And does anybody ever say, thanks for asking, but keep the objects and continue to display them?
It does happen, and it continues to happen. You know, a few years ago, we had an ambassador from the Maasai Nation, and he was visiting San Diego. And through, you know, we were put in contact with him, and he really wanted to come to the museum to see what objects from his community we held. And so we brought out all the objects that we thought were Maasai that were listed, you know, in our database as Maasai or Maasai adjacent, or we weren't sure of. And he looked through them, and he was, you know, first of all, very helpful and was able to, you know, identify some objects as Maasai and some that weren't. But we asked, should these objects be returned? And he said, no, none of these objects are ones that we feel should be returned to the community. But we would ask that you care for them in a culturally sensitive way. And so, you know, there's a tradition of conservation and stewardship of objects that's in the Western world is very science-based and, you know, includes things like wrapping some objects in plastic to protect them from pests or moisture or this kind of thing. And many indigenous communities feel these objects have life. And, you know, he told us right away this, for example, there was a spear and he said, you're wrapping this in plastic. It can't breathe. It can't live. And you really need to be conditioning the surface of the spear with lamb's fat. And that's what helps keep it alive. And you know what's interesting? As soon as we started treating that spear in that fashion, it looks entirely different. And so we really adapted our care of that object to follow the cultural traditions of the Maasai people.
So the museum may actually end up more appropriately, more accurately reflecting and talking about these objects as a result of this process.
Exactly. And that's really one of the overarching goals. You know, the objects that we do have on display, we want to make sure that all those objects are on display with the consent of the community. And not only that, but that the interpretation of those objects is through the community's voice, not through the voice of a Western, you know, middle-aged white anthropologist. We want it to really the voice of that community to come through with the interpretation of those objects.
By the time this project is over, are you going to come into the museum someday and there won't be anything in it because you will have given everything away?
I don't think that'll be the case at all. You know, we've worked, for example, in recent years with members of the Mayan diaspora community on one of the kind of primary exhibits at the museum since we opened in 1915 of Mayan objects. And you know, with working with that community, there were a number of objects that they asked to be removed from display, but there were a number of objects that they wanted to continue to be on display at the museum, but they really wanted the story to come across of how those objects came to the museum. And so that people could understand how those objects were taken from their homes and are in display in museums all over the world, because I think people don't ask those questions. You know, how did that object really come to be in San Diego, London, New York, Berlin? Why are Mayan objects in these museums?
It's not just describing the object, it's describing the history of the object and how it got to where it is today.
Exactly. And, you know, many of the examples in our Mayan exhibit, for example, there were quite a lot of you know, United States companies that gum companies and fruit companies that sent their people down to Mexico and Central America, where these companies bought land, and those employees often brought objects back that they, you know, that they found or they bought from people who were undergoing economic insecurity or all kinds of reasons that these, you know, but there were definitely power dynamics that happened in those situations. And these objects came back to the United States and then were donated to museums all over.
So you may end up with as many objects or even more objects than you started with.
Yeah, I kind of doubt there'll be more objects, but I do think the objects that we will have, we can have with really a good feeling of how we're holding them and representing those communities across the world.
That's very interesting. This is the podcast Making Change, and I'm Jeff Dunnigan, your host. You can subscribe to Making Change wherever you get your podcasts. On Making Change, we interview people whose goal is significant change in our region. Right now, we're talking about how museums change and adapt with James Hadan at the Museum of Us. So, Shelby White is a New Yorker and a collector of objects from ancient civilizations. And the feds knocked on her door and told her that she was in possession of a large number of stolen objects, but that she wasn't the thief. And they had done their homework, and they had discovered that objects that she now owned had been stolen from indigenous cultures hundreds of years ago. She did her homework, she thought, and there she was holding stolen objects, and the feds took them from her. Is that a isolated case, or is that a story that has meaning?
Well, I think it's a story that we're going to be hearing more and more, you know, as the history of how these objects came into private collections and public collections across the world, you know, these stories really develop more and more. And so I guess the short answer is it's something that we're going to be hearing about more and more. And we also see that museums and collectors across the world are really starting to recognize that collecting is viewed differently than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And that communities that have had objects taken from them through a variety of means are really looking to have those objects come home. And, you know, you see this from World War II, you know, families still fighting to have paintings returned to them that the Nazis took, and somehow those got into public collections. And some museums really pushing back against that. But public opinion is really turning, and you can see that in many cases across the world.
District Attorney of New York County, Alvin Bragg.
Today is historic and groundbreaking. We are returning these beautiful works, these drawings, to their rightful home, to their family. This incredible art collection was stolen by the Nazi regime. Mr. Grunbaum was one of a kind, a popular cabaret performer, writer, actor, and director in Austria during the interwar period. In addition to all of those descriptors, as I think you can see before you, he had an eye for beautiful art, an incredible depth and spirit reflected in his collection, which spanned over hundreds of pieces. And I think we all know the history. After the Nazis invaded Austria, they coerced him and his wife to turn over his collection to the regime. In the more than 70 years since those pieces were ripped away from their rightful owners, they've passed literally around the globe. Eventually, and fortunately for purposes of our work here, traveling through New York and Manhattan. Traveling to some of the most famous museums and collections in the world, including the Museum of Modern Art right here in Midtown Manhattan. Now, they're returning to where they belong, back to his family, where they always should have been.
In a way, if museums have always been the sources of information about objects and about scholarship about civilizations or about objects, you're really just adding a layer of knowledge onto this whole situation. You're not giving things away. You're reestablishing what's the meaning of stewardship, what's the meaning of ownership, right?
Exactly. And we're adding a new layer of information really more directly from the people from where those objects came from. Really, you know, throughout time, we've been seeing these objects kind of through a filter. And it's been a filter of a certain kind of academic understanding of those objects, which are often one or two steps removed from the people that made those objects. And so this really represents a shift from that, and one that I'm really hopeful that people will embrace.
Do you ever get a dispute where two individuals or two peoples both claim the same objects?
Well, I think there have been disputes. And really, so far, and we're only 10 years into kind of this decolonizing process at the museum, and we have, you know, tens of thousands of objects. So I can't say what will happen in the future. You know, the ones that we've had right now have been mostly in objects that have been NAGPRA related. So we've had a specific process that we can really look to. And I say that because we really, you know, the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, especially prioritized NAGPRA objects, because those were kind of the first that we really needed to take care of and make sure that those objects are being returned to the community, because those objects especially are dealing with funerary and grave goods and human remains, and so ancestors. So we've, you know, established a priority, and so we really have been prioritizing those objects and consultations first. And it's really in the last couple of years where we've started to institute the Colonial Pathways policy, and it's really been gathering steam in the last, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, mostly. And so far, there haven't been disputes in those returns of objects. But, you know, in all honesty, I anticipate there will be, and we will cross that bridge when we come to it.
From an academic point of view, that could well add to the story about the objects if it turns out that different peoples claim them.
Yes, I certainly see that happening, because I think, you know, already, you know, that I have a better understanding of Native American populations and communities in the San Diego area. And, you know, from my mindset, I have, you know, I tend to look at things with maps and boundaries, but, you know, that's a very Western look. And so these areas where different communities lived often overlapped. And so there's very, you know, real situations where communities will say, that's my, that object belongs to our community more than the other, because these geographic areas overlapped often. And so even in my personal example, I understand how people interacted pre-contact in San Diego much better now that I've been at the museum and have seen kind of some of these stories play out around the materials that were created by people locally.
The descriptions that I see on the walls in museums presumably are written by scholars or by museum curators. Have you changed the way you write those descriptions based on this activity?
We have. And I think the first one, and I mentioned the Mayan exhibit, that the text in the Mayan exhibit now is really written by a group of Mayan scholars and community members, and so that we worked with. And so it's the text on the wall are their voices. It's not, you know, a curator at this museum. In fact, we don't have curators anymore. We have exhibit developers who work with community members to develop the exhibits. So we no longer have a position called a curator at the Museum of Us.
That's maybe more radical than the whole decolonizing activity. Are you unique in that regard relative to museums?
Well, I don't know every museum, but my feeling is we probably are. But you do certainly see all museums, but you do see many museums now working on community-driven exhibits. That kind of phrase is becoming really prevalent now in the museum field, but we've really taken it, you know, several steps farther, I think, by no longer having a traditional, you know, academically trained curator in the common sense at a museum. So we don't have that position.
You're listening to the Making Change podcast that explores people and organizations committed to positive change. We've been hearing from James Hadan about museums, specifically the Museum of Us in Balboa Park. In coming episodes, we'll talk with other cultural leaders here in San Diego and in Southern California, as well as innovators in healthcare, genomics, and housing. I'm your host, Jeff Dunnigan, and you can subscribe to the Making Change podcast wherever you get your podcasts. What about fundraising? Has this had an effect on fundraising at the museum? I'm sure you rely heavily on philanthropy.
We do. You know, 40-50% of our budget is through contributed revenue. And so it has. Our funding base is evolving. We've been very successful with fundraising, but it does mean that there have been traditional funders that, as we say, we've blessed and released. We've thanked them for, you know, their continuing support of the museum over the years, but we understand that this direction that the museum is moving and has dived deep into now may not be the direction that they're comfortable with. And so we always want to lead with gratitude for all the support. But, you know, more and more we have funders across the nation and the country that are really recognizing this kind of work. And so, you know, we still have been successful with fundraising. And also this work is very expensive. You know, consulting with Native American and Indigenous communities takes a lot of time. And it means there's not just, you know, for example, as we talked about in exhibit development, it isn't one curator who's kind of the boss of it all, who writes the content. You know, you're working with a whole group of community members, and that takes much longer to produce a final exhibit text when you're working with, you know, six or seven people or more.
But taking longer to write a museum text has the potential to make for a significantly better museum text. I mean, in a way, you're just enhancing and strengthening what museums have always done.
Yeah, and that's exactly, we're working on a new exhibit that will replace one of our core exhibits now called Race, Are We So Different? The new exhibit is called Race, Power, Resistance, and Change. And it's really to really look at this idea of structural racism and its effects, especially locally in our region. And you know, we've been working with, you know, a number of people in that kind of realm of study and community access all around this issue for the last 2 years to develop content for that exhibit. And we really are proud of what we're seeing in the content development of that exhibit. And so we're really excited that that'll be opening in the next year, so in 2025.
It seems like a lot of people think of museums as apolitical, neutral, and intellectual arbiters. And it also seems like you might be walking in the direction of being political. Are you worried about navigating that? Are you worried about how that gets interpreted?
Well, I think, you know, we number one, want to be authentic to ourselves. And I think the museum and the staff don't feel that museums are neutral, even if that's what we've kind of hoped that we were always in the past. You know, if you're presenting a certain interpretation of objects, that has a point of view. And so that, at its very base, is not neutral. If you have Western academically trained curators in the past, those are really kind of sharing a narrative of the, culturally dominant force, so to speak. And so we really feel that our job here at the museum is to present these narratives that we haven't heard or have been silenced in the past. So we really feel that we're leaning into these human stories. And so we feel that leaning into human stories isn't political. It's sharing human stories. If people take from that political directions, then that's what they're taking. You know, what we're doing is really sharing human stories.
And it's an indicator that museums are respected for being able to navigate those debates and those discussions. A decade ago or so, when schools stopped arts education, K through 12 did, it seems like they handed that charge off to museums, or at least museums picked up the charge and have been handling that responsibility of public education. So now one more responsibility is being handed off to museums.
Yes. And, I think that's also another discussion. And I think, Crystal Bridges Museum, for example, did some really great studies on the importance of coming to museums are for student groups. And I think that can't really be underestimated. And there's a lot of study going on across the nation in the museum field. We just participated in a museum goers survey in 2024, early 2024, that the American Alliance of Museums studied. And it was over 90,000 participants. And some of the ideas that they were looking at in that study is what role museums have in developing hope and empathy in communities. And it was really interesting to see some of the responses, because across the nation, many people thought that's great that museums do that. But there was about 20% who said that's not the job of museums to do that. And so we do see that this kind of polarized discourse that is happening in the country. Also, certainly museums are not immune to that.
But hope and empathy have been products of museums, regardless of whether it was their formal charge, forever.
Exactly. And we're certainly leaning into that. These stories that we share, we want them to spark empathy and share resilience of humanity. And, all of these kinds of experiences that make us all human.
It's interesting that you mentioned Crystal Bridges Museum, because that museum was brought to life by Don Bacigalupi, who used to be the director of the San Diego Museum of Art, and Alice Walton brought him to the Crystal Bridges Museum. So there's another example of a Balboa Park museum being a leader in its field and providing benefit to the entire museum community.
Yeah, and that's, even growing that now that they have a separate foundation, which is doing some really interesting work about sharing objects, across museums, so that, many museums have so many objects that are in storage, and they kind of match museums up and make sure that objects are actually being seen by more people. And so there's a lot of exciting work going on to really make sure that all these materials that museums have that are so important to humanity really can be seen by more people.
What opens next at the Museum of Us?
So I mentioned our new race exhibit, which we're working on now. We had a really wonderful grant from the Prebys Foundation, which means that we're kicking off production of that exhibit. It's called Race, Power, Resistance, and Change. And key features of of that exhibit will be some really amazing artworks created by local BIPOC artists. And so we're really starting the commissioning of those of those art pieces now, kind of later this year, and then production of that exhibit will happen throughout 2025. And that exhibit will be taking place, it'll be taking the place of our current animals exhibit, and which will mean kind of a big reshuffle on the second floor of the museum. So there'll be other exhibits being installed too. Some of those are still being finalized right now, but I really encourage everybody to be on the lookout for quite a bit of change with exhibits happening in 2025 at the Museum of Us.
That's great. Thanks for joining me on Making Change, the podcast devoted to learning about making big changes in Southern California and around the world. I'm your host, Jeff Dunnigan. Subscribe, like, listen, and drive carefully.
The Making Change podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or as the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice and would recommend listeners obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services offers investment advisory services in the capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important listeners understand ways in which UBS conducts business and that UBS carefully reads the agreements and disclosures that UBS provides about the products and services that UBS offers. For more information, please review client relationship summaries provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.